You're listening to CJLY 93.5 FM, Kootenai Cooperative Radio in Nelson, British Columbia. Welcome to Peace Watch Middle East, an exploration of peacemakers and peacemaking in the Middle East. Specifically, the Peace Watch Middle East series talks to people on both sides, Palestinians and Israelis. They may be engaged in nonviolent direct action, or in bicultural cooperation, or in the development of civil society. This January, a group of Israeli veterans published a letter in which they declared that they would no longer serve in the occupied territories. That letter goes like this. We reserve combat officers and soldiers of the Israeli Defense Forces, who were raised upon the principles of Zionism, sacrifice, and giving to the people of Israel and to the State of Israel, who have always served in the front lines and who were the first to carry out any mission, light or heavy, in order to protect the State of Israel and strengthen it. We combat officers and soldiers who have served the State of Israel for long weeks every year, in spite of the dear cost to our personal lives, have been on reserve duty all over the occupied territories, and were issued commands and directives that had nothing to do with the security of our country, and that had the sole purpose of perpetuating our control over the Palestinian people. We whose eyes have seen the bloody toll this occupation exacts from both sides, we who sensed how the commands issued to us in the territories destroy all the values we had absorbed while growing up in this country, we who understand now that the price of occupation is the loss of IDF's human character and the corruption of the entire Israeli society, we who know that the territories are not Israel and that all settlements are bound to be evacuated in the end, we hereby declare that we shall not continue to fight this war of the settlements. We shall not continue to fight beyond the 1967 borders in order to dominate, expel, starve, and humiliate an entire people. We hereby declare that we shall continue serving in the Israeli Defense Forces in any mission that serves Israel's defense. The missions of occupation and oppression do not serve this purpose, and we shall take no part in them. Unlike Canada, Israel has a system of universal military service. Men and women alike are required to serve in the military after they finish high school. After a period of active duty, each citizen then is called up for about a month of reserve duty every year. Women in Israel are allowed to have conscientious objector status, but there is no similar status for men. So the refuseniks are all men who have served their active duty, many of them in Lebanon. Many of them have also served some of their reserve duty, but what they are refusing to continue to serve is the annual reserve duty when that duty is in the occupied territories, when it's in the West Bank or Gaza, more often in the West Bank. I spoke to Elad Lahav in April of this year after he had just been released from military prison. He was in prison for refusing to serve in the territories, and after he was released from prison, he came to Canada. Parts of this interview were broadcast on KCR earlier this year and printed in a Canadian internet magazine, rabble.ca. I wanted to present this more complete, extended conversation because it seems important to me to understand the refuseniks not just as news items, but as human beings. Elad Lahav talks about his family, his comrades in arms, the relationship between Zionism and his social ideals, the failure of the Camp David talks and Barak's generous offer, and his hopes for the future. He spoke to me from Toronto at the beginning of what turned into a cross-country speaking tour. I began by asking him what started him thinking that he might refuse to serve in the territories.
I have been a peace activist throughout my life. What you have to understand that in Israel, serving in the army and being a peace activist does not necessarily contradict. So when I went to the army and after serving 3 years in mandatory service and afterwards went to reserve, it was always a dilemma for me. As long as the Oslo Agreement on, and it looked to be like the beginning of the end for the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, I always convinced myself that by serving in the army, even serving beyond the 1967 borders, is just something temporal, something that will end, and Palestinians will have a state. What we're doing now is just a matter of handing over the power to them. But when the Intifada broke in 2000, and after being in Ramallah in January 2001, I realized I could no longer, in good conscience, serve in the occupied territories.
What was it that happened in Ramallah?
We were there for about a month, and it was very difficult for me. See, even though we did not commit any atrocities as the kind you would have think about in the aspect of war crimes, it was all about harassing the civilian population. It was in the name of security for Israeli settlements, settlements which I do not agree with, and people whom I have a very bad time understanding what they want and how they feel.
Tell us a little bit about the settlements. Talk about that some. In fact, you've said that when people talk about settlements, that sometimes it means one thing and sometimes it means another, that the word means several different types of communities in Israel.
Yeah, when you refer to settlements in English, it basically you think about towns and villages, but it has turned to be the settlements in the context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict is those that are beyond the 1967 border. And those settlements began as a movement after 1967 that claimed that the entire occupied territories that were occupied during the 1967 war were part of Israel. The motives are mainly religious, and they, whoever lives there, most of them think of them as the promised land.
I see.
And for me as a secular person, it is very hard to understand and very hard to agree with, because as I see it, and as many people in Israel see it, had only they were not there, we could have had peace a long time ago. So in Ramallah, we were basically there to protect them. It had nothing to do, as I saw it and many of my comrades saw it, it had nothing to do with the security of people within Israel, which is very important for us.
Why? I don't understand how this religious motivation came about only in 1967. I think a lot of people on this side of the Atlantic think that the establishing of the Israeli state in 1948 was motivated by religion. Most people, I think, see Zionism as a religious movement. But you describe yourself as secular. Can you clarify that?
Yeah, Zionism was from the beginning a very secular movement. It was based on the national movements that rose throughout Europe and even in America during the 19th century. And as opposed to the religious people, the religious Jews, who claim that one should wait for the apocalypse, for the return of Jews to Israel, the secular Jews went and said that they wanted to establish a country, a nation, which is very much like France or England or Germany. A normal nation of secular people that can live without the fear of being harassed as they were in Europe.
So the motivation for this, for Zionism, is largely the persecutions, the pogroms, and then eventually the Holocaust. It's a secular attempt to establish a sanctuary or to establish a place where those kinds of things can't happen.
Of course, and this is very important in the context of the current conflict. I will talk about it later, because the mission of the Zionism. The task, the main task, was to establish a safe sanctuary. And what happened in 1967, and this would be difficult for those who are not Jewish or do not know enough about Judaism, some people in Israel saw the war, the great victory in 1967, when in just 6 days the major Arab armies were crushed, as a miracle, as a heavenly miracle, which for some of them, the more extremists, looked as the beginning of the apocalypse. And they thought it was time for Messiah, and that God was sending them a signal that he wanted the Jews to have the entire land, as was prophesied in the Old Testament.
I see.
And this is something that for the majority, secular majority of Israel, is very hard to understand.
Right. Okay. Let's carry on with your story. You were telling us about Ramallah. You were telling us about what it was that happened in Ramallah that put your feet on the path of signing this letter to refuse to fight in the territories.
Okay, so my company friends and I were mostly stationed in roadblocks and in outposts on the outskirts of Ramallah. Since 1994, Ramallah, the main city of Ramallah, is controlled by the Palestinian Authority, and Israelis cannot enter. So we were on the outskirts of Ramallah.
So is that an Area A?
Yeah.
Okay.
Ramallah is Area A, and we were exactly on the border of Area A, and between Ramallah and the settlements, the Jewish settlements that surround it.
I see.
And we were stationed mainly in roadblocks, where we had to keep to monitor Palestinians' vehicles that were going from Jericho to Ramallah, and we had to search these vehicles and take those people's identification cards and passports for examination. And sometimes when the general who is commissioned over the entire area ordered so, we had to turn them back because Ramallah for some times was being off limits for Palestinians. And it created very, very difficult situations where you see people who were driving their cars for many hours, because the distance between Jericho and Ramallah, it's about an hour's drive. But because of the roadblocks, people could have been on their way for 5 hours then, and just before getting to Ramallah, were not allowed to enter the Palestinian section and were forced to go back.
Another question: Jericho is also in Area A, or
yeah.
Is,
okay. Yeah, all major Palestinian cities are now Area A.
Okay.
Only the rural area is controlled by Israel.
So the space in between these two cities is controlled by Israel, but
yes.
The cities themselves are controlled by the Palestinian Authority.
Yes.
Okay.
And this is the reason why most Israelis feel that the Palestinians were already given independence. They do not understand actually the difference between an independent state and some sort of group of independent cities. Because if you live in a city and you cannot get out, and when you do get out, you're being examined and stopped and harassed by soldiers, you can hardly call it an independent state.
Right.
It's some sort of a municipal autonomy, but nothing more. And this is what many Israelis do not understand.
So this was what eventually led to your feeling that you could no longer support the checkpoints, is it fair to say, harassing of Palestinians on the way from Jericho to Ramallah?
This is one of the things. These were my experiences. I did not take part in things like door-to-door searches, but I saw it, and it made me very uncomfortable. The big dilemma was that we actually have terrorism in Israel. It's not some fairy tale.
Right.
It actually happens. So you're torn between the anger and the desire to protect your fellow citizens, your countrymen.
Of course.
And between the means that the army or the state tells you you have to take, which you know that you have nothing to do with the security of Israel, but only the perpetuating of the conquest of the occupation. And finally, there was... I've had difficult time between my service in Ramallah and when I was called back to duty, which happened on March of this year. But 2 weeks before my duty, there was an incident that convinced me. I heard on the radio that seven reserve soldiers were killed in a roadblock by a Palestinian sniper. And this was, for one, was very sad, but not so unusual. What was unusual were the was what I saw on television. Because on television I saw that they were inside this very small, very narrow, very high creek, which is, tactically speaking, a suicide location. And they were only there because of political reasons, because the settlers wanted them to be there to show the Palestinians that there is, that there are Israeli outposts everywhere. And so for political reasons, seven men died. And I could no longer bear with this thought. So I decided, on that evening I called my company commander and told him I would no longer take part in any actions beyond the 1967 border.
Okay. Mr. Sharon has been quoted. I think it's Mr. Sharon. It might be Mr. Ben Eliezer. Someone very high in the Israeli government, at any rate, has been quoted as saying if soldiers in a democracy were allowed to obey only those orders that please them, the result would be chaos and anarchy. So what do you say to that? When you talk to your commanding officer, you must have had to deal with something like that.
Yes, my commanding officer was very understanding. I didn't think he would be, because in Israel, serving in the army is very important, and obeying commands when you are within the army is very important. I don't think the Israeli army has ever had a mutiny. So the main thing he spoke about was democracy. How can a person like me go against democratic decisions? But this is entirely untrue. I have two answers to these allegations, because this is the main point thrown at us nowadays. Israel is a democracy, and you have to obey the decisions of the majority. The first thing I have to say is that democracy is not some technical facility that only comes to the help of the decisions of the majority. The democracy is based on certain values that cannot be separated from the word democracy. It's values like liberty and equality and fraternity. And when you, by vote of the majority, decide on something which contradicts by its nature these very same values, it can't be called a democracy. The second thing is that today, within the borders of Greater Israel or Greater Palestine, whatever you'd like to call it, I mean Israel in the 1967 borders and the occupied territories, you have about 10 million people. Only 6 million of them, the Israeli citizens, were allowed to vote and decide whether they want to keep or return the occupied territories. This is absurd. Suppose that United States citizens who decide by majority that they wanted to keep Canada as a part of the United States. Would this be a democratic decision? Of course not. It's ridiculous.
That's a popular joke in Canada. No, of course not.
And what we learned from history, that at certain times, soldiers must disobey the orders. To remain human, it's much more important than democracy, just to remain human.
What followed from that decision? You went to your commanding officer, you told him that you would not serve in the territories. He was understanding, he challenged your decision, but you stuck by your guns. Then what? What are the consequences of such a decision?
He tried to get me a non-combat job for this reserve duty, but it involved guarding a facility inside the occupied territories, and I had already told him I would not do anything outside the 1967 borders.
At this time, had you yet signed the letter?
No, I did not want to sign the letter because I did not want to put the army in a position that it felt it needed to punish me.
Uh-huh.
I wanted to settle this with my own commanders and to be restationed as a soldier in duty, in combat duty, somewhere else, along the northern border or the Egyptian border, because I still think, and this is my main issue, that Israel needs to defend itself. I just do not want to take part of an offensive act.
You have served in Lebanon, right?
Yes.
And so that's a whole different kettle of fish.
Yes, but it's because of the state in Lebanon and the outcome of the 18-year-old war, I think this has made a great impact on all of us. All of us who signed that letter, that we do not want any longer to fight futile, unnecessary wars. So when my commanding officer could not find me another post, I went to the battalion commander on the day of recruitment and was tried and sent to 28 days of military prison.
And so when was that?
That was on March 17th.
So that's not all that long ago.
No. No, I'm just out of the jail.
Uh-huh. What was that like for you? Where was the prison?
The prison was inside Israel, very close to my parents' house. It sounds terrible talking about military prison, but it's actually not that. It's not Oslo, something like that. It's just a bunch of tents surrounded by a fence. And basically because we are reservists and older than usual standard army folks, we were kept pretty much alone and we didn't do much apart from reading a lot and washing our own dishes. But being away from my family, away from my wife, away from my work for 28 days, surrounded by fences and guards, is still not a very delightful experience.
No, it's still prison. How did your family respond to this?
My family totally supported me. They were even... they wanted me to refuse even before I wanted to, because they only saw one side of it. They only saw the acts that were being done on the occupied territories. What they did not understand is how I feel towards my comrades in the company. These are people I have been doing reserve service with for 5 years. We are friends. I would like to think of us as friends. I don't know how they think of me currently. And it's very difficult saying to them, okay, I'm not coming with you this time. You'll have to get there on your own.
Mm-hmm.
And so I didn't want to refuse at first, and try to convince myself I can get it off with doing things as morally as I could.
Mm-hmm. A reassignment to someplace else.
Before I thought of reassignment, I just told myself I'll go away with my company and just try to behave morally on roadblocks and on patrols or any other duties.
Oh, I see, yes. Uh-huh.
But this is just kidding yourself, because you can be a very moral person, only that once you're situated in such a conflict where emotions are so high, so tense, you find yourself doing things you wouldn't thought you were capable of. I'll just give you a very simple example. When we were on the outskirts of Ramallah, Palestinian kids used to confront us throwing stones. And throughout the world, Israel is condemned for using firearms against stones. But you have to understand that once these stones are being thrown at you in a tremendous power with a huge amount of stones coming all over the sky become black. You find yourself, and these stones can kill you. You find yourself with your gun. One thing, it's a very primitive feeling, the wish to defend yourself. So unless you are stationed with this in this situation, you wouldn't have to use your weapons. This is what we say to the Israeli public today. I cannot blame a soldier who has opened fire on kids who are throwing stones. As it sounds very bad, but unless you've seen it, you
no,
can't
I understand.
Imagine how
stones are weapons. I mean, people can be hurt. People can be killed by stones.
Yeah, stones were weapons a long time before guns were.
That's right.
So you want to defend yourself. You want to get alive of this situation, but you find yourself doing immoral things. So this entire situation puts you in a place where you can no longer act as a moral person, even if you want to. So this is what we say today to the Israeli public. We do not want to be in such situations that impose so grave dilemmas upon us. Thank you.
Daniel Kulak from his Life on a String album. The tune is called The Lion's Den. You're listening to CJLY 93.5 FM on your radio dial. This is Kootenai Cooperative Radio, Nelson, BC. My name is Jim Terrell, and this is Peace Watch Middle East. I've been talking to Elad Lahav, an Israeli refusnik. And now back to that interview. Elad, in your trial, you said, "I refuse to serve in the occupied territories because when my children grow up, I want to be able to look them in the eyes." What future do you hope for Israel and for your children?
I want us to be a state, a normal state, just like any other. It's difficult for me to speak about it because currently, I can't see a future for it, to be honest. Emotions have grown so high on both sides, and hatred currently rules the thoughts of everyone, Palestinians and Israelis. And the only thing people talk about is revenge. So in this situation, you can hardly imagine what we thought would be possible 10 years ago, that Israel and Palestine, an independent Palestinian state, would coexist and have some sort of cooperation, civil cooperation, economical cooperation. What I wish now is just that we've had peace, not in the formal meaning of the word, but tranquility. I don't think we can talk about cooperation. But if we only had time, that Israel withdrew to its borders and Palestinians would have their own country. We don't have to speak to each other. We don't have to see each other. We just need to let things rest for a couple of years, perhaps even many years, before we can talk about being neighbors.
Tell me something about the refusnik movement. It seems, as you speak about the hatred on both sides, I want to say, well, no. You represent yourself something other than that. You are an alternative to that. And so, in this admittedly very dark time for Israel and for the Palestinians, it seems that something is growing out of that. Can you tell us more about this movement?
I can hardly call it a movement because it's only now getting its first shape, its initial shape of a movement. It began with a bunch of officers and NCOs. All veterans of Lebanon or service in the occupied territories, all in combat duty, who said, "We are not willing to do this anymore." It was not a political movement, it was not a social movement, it was just a bunch of guys who were tired of the situation. And as opposed to other, let's say, pacifist movements, these officers and NCOs, including myself, are willing to serve in the army.
Right. Do you? Let me stop you there. Do you see yourself or yourselves as part of a pacifist movement, as a variation of pacifism?
No, it's not pacifism. We would all like to be pacifists, but we can see that Israel is still being threatened. And I believe, for one, that when you are threatened, you have to defend yourself. The only question is what you do in order to defend yourself, and whether the acts you are doing are actually defense or whether they are offense and aggression. And what we said, that we are willing to keep on serving. We love Israel. We want to be Israelis. And we want to serve Israel. And as long as it is in a moral point of view, as long as we are not oppressors, as long as we do not serve the occupation, because the occupation has nothing to do with the defense of Israel. And so the letter came. It was publicized some months ago with only 50 signers who initiated this whole process. And this is an extremely brave thing to do in an Israeli society which is very militarized. And the notion of military service is, I think, a holy establishment. And to say this thing publicly, we are not willing to serve the army on certain conditions, it's a very brave thing to do in Israel. Not that you're punished, 28 days in military prison, it's not such a grave punishment when you think about other rebels in the history. But our main punishment is the way that society treats us now. Because if an officer who had been in Lebanon and fought in Lebanon for what he was thinking was the defense of Israel is now being called a traitor, this is very difficult.
So that's happening in Israel now. The refuseniks are being called traitors?
Yes.
If you went back to Israel today, would you be able to go back to your job, or would you be prevented from working?
No. The acts that are taken upon us, beside the military punishment, which only takes place if you actually refuse. By signing the letter, you do not yet refuse to serve. You're just making a statement.
Mm-hmm.
And you can make a statement. It's a free state. Currently. But when you actually refuse to go, you're imprisoned for between 28 to 35 days, which is about the time you would have been in active duty otherwise. But there are no criminal acts against you. I go to my work, and people who know me for what I am, not just the slogan or the label, he's a refusenik, some of them agree, some of them don't, but no one will fire me or stop talking with me for that.
Right. You wouldn't be prevented from getting a loan or
board of
directors
not.
Or something like that?
Of course not.
Right, okay. One of the things that the public letter says is, it says the price of occupation is the loss of the IDF's human character and the corruption of the entire Israeli society. And it speaks of destroying the values that you were taught as children, that you absorbed as children.
Yes.
Could you elaborate on that some?
Yes. The Israeli society in Israel at all is very proud of the moral stance of the army. As children, we grew on stories telling about... I can give you two examples. During the Independence War, a platoon that was sent to the region of Jerusalem found an was encountered by an Arab shepherd who they knew will go to the Arab side and tell them the exact position. However, they could not find it in themselves to detain him. So they let him go, and he told their position, and they were all killed. And another story is about a colonel in the army that was fired by Ben-Gurion, Israel's first prime minister, for stealing two sacks of sugar. And these stories made us very proud, made us think and believe that we have a very moral army. The initials IDF stand for Israeli Defense Forces. That we have our army and we go to the army only because other people want to hurt us. And this image of the army has suffered a lot since 1982 with the war in Lebanon and the first intifada and the second intifada. And currently, although the stories and the image keep living, more and more people come to realize that there are faults in this image. And it's very difficult, and most of the Israeli people will not accept this. But when you're positioned, I go back to my point that I cannot blame the soldiers who are actually doing the duty in an impossible situation. I only blame the politicians for putting them in and the generals for putting them in situations that are impossible.
Another thing that the public statement says that piqued my curiosity, it says, we know that the territories are not Israel and that all settlements are bound to be evacuated in the end. Do you believe that? Is that really true?
It's true. It's just a question of time. And I don't know how much time will it take. And frankly, I'm not convinced today that at the end of this process, the Israeli state as we have come to know it would actually maintain or survive the situation. But the territories will not be forever in Israeli hands. You must understand, out of a population of 6 million Israelis, only 200,000 live in the territories. Most of them live there because of economic reasons. It was cheaper to buy houses there. Only about a quarter of them, to my estimation, live there out of sheer ideology. So what we have here is about 50,000 people who are forcing their will on a total of 10 million Israelis and Palestinians. This is a situation that cannot perpetuate, cannot continue for very long. I only hope that it will be resolved in terms of peace and not of war.
Right before I left, I checked my email, and I had in my email an announcement that about the, I'm probably going to mispronounce this, the Shminitzim, the 12th graders.
Yeah, Shminitzim.
Shminitzim. Apparently there's a new petition. This is a group of 12th grade students who have undertaken a protest that's similar in some ways to the one that we're talking about here. And the letter that I received was a letter to say that their original petition saying that they would not, I think that what they're saying is that they won't serve in the IDF. I'm not sure about that.
Yes, this is what they're saying. I understand their move, but I can't agree with it. Israel has a mandatory service of 3 years. And I, for myself, was offered a very nice desk job when I went to the army. But I couldn't stand the thought of someone else fighting for me in the combat field. So I joined the infantry corps. It's very hard for me to accept someone saying, I will not give my shirt all. I think that within the army, you can help defend Israel or even do social work without being part of the occupation. But I respect their ideas.
As I listen to you talk, I hear your story and I read about your story, it seems to me that it's a story of a moral crisis. And it seems to me that a couple of the elements of that moral crisis are elements of Zionism and sacrifice, a kind of sacrifice that you just mentioned, that you could have had a cushy desk job and you didn't want to do that for moral reasons. Do you see any other dimensions to that moral crisis besides the ones that I've mentioned? Can you help me analyze that, pull that apart a little bit and see the cross currents of that for you?
It's not only myself, but I think the entire movement or entire political section of the map that I belong to was forced to deal with throughout the existence of Israel. I belong to a section which is affiliated both with Zionism and with socialism. The two things have a tendency to contradict each other. On the one hand, I want, and we want, an Israeli state, a Jewish homeland. On the other hand, we want it to be just and to be a moral example. We wanted it to be a moral example to other countries. And so you have this dualism that's intervened with the Israeli history, and especially the history of its left. The right wing in Israel doesn't have these moral issues. He wants a Jewish state, period. He wants it to be safe, period. And whatever means necessary for that, it's okay. We want it to be moral. And we want it not to be in the way of regional prosperity. We wanted Israel to become the center of regional prosperity, along with our Arab neighbors. And this is something that you have to maneuver within those two angles, two points of view. So it's a dilemma that's ongoing throughout our history.
Elad, how can Canadians support you and the others in your situation through this difficult time?
Before anyone supports myself or any other group, I want them to understand the situation. And a lot of statements from both sides of the political angle are based on ignorance. People do not understand, do not know the exact story. So before you make a stand, I really would like anybody who wants to make a stand, even get to the internet, try or get to a library, and try to understand the history of the region, the history of the conflict. A lot is myth. A lot is myth. And you have to find the truth within this story. because I hear a lot of things that really make me angry. And
like what?
For one side, there are a lot of accusations about the Israeli army using the tactics of the Nazis. This is completely ignorant, because either you do not know what was the Holocaust all about, or you do not, you're not familiar with the Israeli-Arab conflict. There have been atrocities on both sides. None of them reaches the level of the Holocaust, and this should not be used as an issue in the debate at all. On the other hand, you hear statements like the Israel is the homeland of the Jewish people, and there were no Arabs when the first Jews came back from Europe. This is nonsense as well. You have to get familiar with the conflict and with the history of the region before you make a stand. Even if you want to make a stand that supports me, but it comes from ignorance, I would not want it to happen.
Elad Lahav, thank you very much for being with us today.
Okay, thank you.
Another tune from Daniel Kulak's Life on a String album. It's called the Anti-Angst Tune. Next Friday, November 8th, Scott Kennedy will be speaking at the Nelson United Church in the lower hall at 7 p.m. Scott Kennedy has recently returned from the Middle East. He was there with a delegation from the Fellowship of Reconciliation. FOR is one of the oldest multi-faith peace organizations in the world. Kennedy's talk on November 8th will be the inaugural event for a Kootenai chapter of the Fellowship of Reconciliation. That's Friday, November 8th in the lower hall of Nelson United Church at 7 p.m. Scott Kennedy is a co-founder and staff member of the Resource Center for Nonviolence in Santa Cruz, California. He serves as a coordinator of the Resource Center's Middle East program. Kennedy was a conscientious objector to the Vietnam War and has been a war tax resister since the early 1970s. He first visited the Middle East in 1968 and has visited the region more than three dozen times. Most recently, this September and October, he was leading a delegation to Lebanon, Jordan, Israel, and Palestine. Kennedy serves on the National Council of the Fellowship of Reconciliation and just completed 2 years as National Chair of the FOR. He co-founded and chaired the FOR Task Force on Latin America and the Caribbean in the early 1980s. Later, he co-founded and currently chairs the FOR Middle East Task Force. He traveled to Iraq on a delegation from FOR with $1.5 million in medical supplies in December of 1990 and helped start the Campaign of Conscience for the Iraqi people. He's author of The Witness Revolt, Doubleday 1972, and co-editor of The Introduction to Albert Camus, Neither Victims Nor Executioners. Scott Kennedy has been elected to three terms on the Santa Cruz City Council and served as mayor of Santa Cruz in 1994. He's a Methodist layperson and is married with three grown children. For more information, contact David Boyd at 352-2822, Bobby Ogletree at 352-3337, or Isaac Romano at 229-4002. Stay tuned for local, national, and international sports with Mike Daglish on Sports Talk. Let me just bring you up to date with what's happening with the refuseniks in Israel. When I interviewed Elad Lahav in April of this year, there were some 360 who had signed the letter. This morning, before I left home for the studio, there were 495. When I talked to him in April, the Sheminit Sim letter, the high school graduates who had indicated that they would refuse to serve either altogether or in the territories, numbered about 125. Today, the number is over 200. David Zonshine is the second signer of the refusenik letter, and he has gone to the Israeli Supreme Court in order to try to persuade the court to hear his case as a formal legal case. So far, all of the refuseniks are tried by their commanding officers in an informal hearing and sentenced to anywhere from 28 to 35 days, depending on the rank of the officer who's trying them. Zonshine risks a three-year sentence if the Supreme Court decides to hear his case.